Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Today, we bring you another installment in the Museum Confidential podcast series, which is co-created by myself and Jeff Martin of Philbrook Museum of Art. The podcast series originated with the exhibit Museum Confidential, which is on view at Philbrook here in Tulsa through May 6th. This podcast explores the well-known Rothko Chapel, established in 1971 in Houston, Texas. It's both a sacred space and a modern art mainstay. Dedicated to non-denominational prayer and private contemplation and to international peace and fellowship, the building routinely hosts lectures, concerts, interfaith gatherings, and similar events. And at its heart, of course, are 14 very dark, luminous, large-scale paintings by Mark Rothko, the late American painter of Russian-Jewish descent. We speak with David Leslie, the executive director of the Rothko Chapel, who interestingly comes from more of a social justice and community organizing background rather than an art history or curatorial background. When I was a younger man, art was a lonely thing. No galleries, no collectors, no critics, no money. Yet it was a golden age, for we all had nothing to lose and a vision to gain. Today it is not quite the same. It is a time of tons of verbiage, activity, consumption. Which condition is better for the world at large, I shall not venture to discuss. But I do know that many of those who are driven to this life are desperately searching for those pockets of silence where we can root and grow. We must all hope we find them. Mark Rothko.
There are many kinds of museums, from the hallowed halls of the Louvre to the humble home of Jesse James, from Tulsa to Tokyo to the Tate Modern. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. On today's episode, we sit down with David Leslie, Executive Director of the Rothko Chapel. He's been at the helm for a few years, but has a long and distinguished career in basically helping people, from working with Habitat for Humanity to spearheading education initiatives in rural Appalachian communities. How does someone dedicated to human rights and interfaith relations bring that work into a space that combines a church and an art gallery? What is the Rothko Chapel? If you're visiting someone, you're traveling around, they ask you what it is, how do you describe this space to someone?
I always tell people it's an amazing interfaith, intercommunity sacred space in Houston that was developed in 1971, kind of growing out of this modern art minimalist movement featuring really notables like Mark Rothko, architect Philip Johnson, who helped design the chapel, Barnett Newman, modern artist, because here on campus we have his one of the broken obelisks here in town. But this idea of a sacred space that really looks at the convergence of art, spirituality, and human rights as forces in our lives that invite personal and societal transformation on behalf of the causes, really timeless causes of peace, justice, and equity. So that's kind of the long elevator spiel.
Your background is very much in, you know, you've worked for Habitat for Humanity, you've worked around the country, you know, really focusing on helping people in many different ways. And your background is not, you know, from art history or being a curator, you come from a very different space. Talk about your journey to the Rothko Chapel and how you ended up there in the first place.
Yeah, it's an interesting question that I've asked myself a lot because it surely wasn't linear. But I think the theme that's just kind of got into my life was the fact that, you know, all of us have gifts and talents. Sometimes we don't know we have embedded in ourselves. We all want to be treated with respect, with dignity. We all want to be affirmed as having a possibility in life. And with that as kind of a principle framework, there are also very, very systemic things in the world that keep us, that keep people from recognizing really their wholeness and what I believe we as human beings are intended to be. So my professional journey, as you noted, yeah, it's taken some very interesting directions in exploring those themes from, you know, affordable housing to the immigration, the migration of people, to healthcare, to, you know, the economic wellness. But as I realized through all of this, and this kind of what got me to the chapel, all along this journey was a framing of what I would call the sacred space, the sacred that's embedded in each of us, the sacredness that's in the world, whether the environment. But it really drove home to me when I was working, particularly in human services, that the very places where people are at sometimes the most at need, the most at risk, are the very places that kind of come off as dehumanizing. They're not very sacred. So you go to a social service office or you're in Section 8 housing, and it just is very dehumanizing.
Yeah, think about a hospital, for example.
Oh, yeah. I mean, public hospitals oftentimes are, you know, not to pick on any one institution, but the places that should be the cleanest are sometimes not very healthy, right? So with that, coming to the chapel, which was interesting because the DeMonnils, John and Dominic DeMonnil, that really were the patrons, the founders of the Rothko Chapel, it just begins with that basic affirmation of the dignity and the worth, the sacredness of any human being anywhere, and that to build a place that you begin with that premise, that it is about discovering, rediscovering. Sometimes it's about finding that in somebody that we have made into the other, and to have this place where we can do that kind of exploration in a different kind of way than a Habitat for Humanity or building a home or a hospital or whatever. It just seemed to be a kind of a cool place to kind of explore this from other dimensions.
It seems like museums have always had this in common with cathedrals or with churches, this sacred space idea that you talk about. And when you go back, you know, especially to the Italian Renaissance and times, you know, there was a lot of overlap in the way people would view art and where they would view art. Many times it was in a church or a cathedral. When you were growing up, was there a museum or a space, an art space, that was a sacred space for you or sometime in your early life?
Now, it's kind of interesting you mentioned that. My father happens to be now retired, but he's a Presbyterian minister. But before he became a minister, he was a pianist and an organist. My mother's an educator. She's a writer. So to some extent, we grew up in a very, you know, culturally rich, humanity-centered kind of environment. It was curious because as a kid, whenever we traveled, we went to museums, we went to concerts, we had music in our home. The church itself, my dad served for all his career, were places that had community concerts, that had, you know, art exhibitions. So maybe I'm unique in that sense that there's no one institution, but there's this kind of environment that was created that I was introduced to really from day one, where I could, you know, have the benefit of seeing how art in its various forms could be really placed anywhere. I mean, it could be in the great museums of the world, but it could also be in a little parish church in a small town in upstate New York.
When people think of the Rothko Chapel, they think of it probably in different ways. Some people think of it because they really love the works by Rothko that are on the walls there. Some of them think of it because of the meditative qualities of the space. Where does it fit within the worlds of, you know, how is it regarded in the museum world? How is it regarded in the world of, you know, the seminary? How is it regarded in those different camps?
You know, my experience here, and the evidence of what I'm going to describe is it comes from the kind of queries we get from those sectors and many others. I think it's held in high esteem in the art world, largely because of the Mark Rothko paintings. I think the interest in Rothko's work continues to grow. Of course, the value continues to grow. And it's a seminal moment in Mark Rothko's artistic career that is, I think, getting more attention. And there's a lot of study academically in that period of his life within a continuum of his work. And, you know, using kind of paraphrasing his own words, where he says, this is kind of the pinnacle of my career, then that opens up a lot of investigation. I think on the kind of the more theological, the spiritual side, going back pretty revolutionary in the day when the Rothko Chapel was dedicated in 1971, at that dedication were Muslims and Jews and Catholics and Protestants and people from other walks of life, where it already had a kind of ecumenicity that was pushing some of the borders and parameters of the time. And so today, we see that here at the chapel always expanding as we look at the world and we look at our own context in Houston, which is one of the most diverse cities, if not the most diverse in the United States. So with that diversity comes this really great breadth of religion, of spirituality, of spiritual questing that we're able to bring into the chapel through meditation, through programs for intersector kind of dialogue. And there's a lot of interest in that, of how do we program that? How do we make that work in a very dialogical fashion? So we have queries coming from really all over the world asking, how do we do that day in and day out? So I think, to come back to your question, the chapel has not become this kind of mausoleum to the past, but in fact is still a very dynamic force within Houston and beyond, in the areas of particularly of art and spirituality, but also in kind of human rights and justice field also.
It's interesting that you say, you know, when you think back to 1971, we talk about the concept of interfaith is very, very common, but that was not a buzzword of the early 1970s. So when you talk about how revolutionary the concept was, especially in a place, you know, Houston is very different now than it was, you know, even demographically in 1971. Obviously, Texas is, you know, and Oklahoma and all these areas have political leanings. But that was truly a revolutionary thing to offer this sacred space for everybody at that time.
Well, I think so. And, you know, I think that it's so true today, and it was very foresightful in late 60s and 70 when this was being envisioned, that it was also a place, it's sacred in the sense it's consecrated, it's a spiritual institution. But from the day one, it was a place that was designed to be welcoming for people of all faiths and those of none. And so you go fast forward now, what, almost 50 years later, and you look at religious demographic trends in America, sort of much like in Western Europe, that the fastest growing sector of the community are those that don't identify with religious markers, the none, right, in that sense. It doesn't mean the person is a spiritual, but it just means that their spirituality is not necessarily tied to a religious belief or perspective or institution. So that's another edge that we continue to live into, is how do we create that sense of dialogue and space that the person who holds a religious identity and belief and belonging, how do we affirm that person and at the same time affirm the person that holds no religious identity, but at the same time might be linked together in kind of very deep questions about worth, value, the health and wellness of our community, the state of the environment for future generations. To be able to continue to live that mission is what we're charged with today, but I assume it's going to be just about as important 50 years from now.
How do you maintain the tone and feeling of the space in the age of technology, where people are wanting to always have a phone with them. Do you have rules or regulations as far as how people can behave in the space so it maintains the kind of reverence that many people are going to the place for?
Right. I mean, that's a great question. One of the things that we really tried to do, and in this sense, being countercultural with a bit of pragmatism, which is to really invite people to turn off their phones, to unhook from technology. And as I say, it, a lot of the we do a lot of public programming. And so if I'm the one that brings the invitation, the welcome that night, I always invite people to be present. I think this is the key word that I've kind of latched onto, and that is to be present with the art that is very much iconography in that sense, or maybe it's an iconography in the sense that it has no images, but to be present with the artwork that invites investigation, invites spiritual questing, to be present with one another, to be present with the program that's being offered that evening, and to really disconnect the best as possible. At the same time, we also recognize that by the time today somebody comes to the Rothko Chapel, they probably have been on our website, they may have downloaded previous programs, they may have looked at TripAdvisor, so they're going to bring a certain level of technology in. And we're always trying to figure out what that balance point is. I'll give you a concrete example. When you come to the chapel, in the foyer, there are holy texts and different readings, books that people are invited to pick up. They want to use that as while they're sitting, meditating or whatever. Well, of course, some people already have that downloaded on their tablet or their phone. And, you know, that's something we don't think is antithetical to the vibe of the chapel. But we do ask that you turn off your don't make phone calls and please don't take pictures. So we do have kind of house rules. But it's, again, it's about presence at the end of the day, not a rule, but to help enhance the experience.
When I first visited the chapel, when you walk into it, and I just want to paint a picture a little bit for the listeners here, it's not a huge space. I don't know the exact square footage of the space, but it's you know, it's not a giant space. You walk into it and you don't see, as you mentioned before, the Rothkos that you may have in your mind. I think the Rothko people have in their mind, you talked about, people think of the reds and the oranges and the blocks of colors. These are much more muted. They're from a very specific time in his life. But also, to me, I felt a very present sense of melancholy when I walked in. And that may be because I know about Mark Rothko and his story. And I know that he had been working on the creation of the chapel and then took his own life before the chapel opened in 1971. And so I may have been bringing some of that with me, but do you see the space as having any inherent feeling one way or another? Is it a joyful space? Is it a melancholy space? Is it whatever you want it to be?
Yes, yes, yes. it's a place that we always invite people to come back to, because you know, on one day, it may be a place of great joy because of something in your life. I mean, it might be a place, that you're there because of a celebratory reason that you want to just sit on and meditate with. At the same time, it may be a place that is providing great solace at a time of loss and all the emotions and life experiences in between. I remind people all the time, and there are those that want to make a connection between the death of Mark Rothko and this must have been the foreshadowing. And I don't think that's very fair. And I think if a person sees a retrospective of Mark's work after he finishes the chapel commission, he's still painting, he's still working for a few more years, and suddenly you see colors and you see different kinds of work. So I never want to make that connection. Others may want to do that, but that, I don't think that's very right. I think that the chapel has to be experienced in multiple ways. And one of the things I have a benefit is I might be there on a Monday, like today it's overcast and cloudy. Tomorrow it might be sunny. You get that range of climate, of colors, of the sky, the movement of clouds. You may be there for a memorial service, as I was last Thursday, and then tomorrow night it's a concert, and then it's a jazz performance. again, recognizing that the chapel is not prescriptive. You bring what you bring, but at the same time, we have the ability to some extent, curate the range of emotions. And I would say this, the way that we as human beings also try to explore meaning, and meaning is oftentimes captured in tears, but it's also captured in laughter and great joy.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by Good Lighting. Paintings, sculptures, works on paper, nearly everything on view in museums is vastly improved by the addition of good lighting. Often ignored and frequently undersung, good lighting is perhaps only truly appreciated when a bulb goes out or the power grid fails. Such is the plight of working class heroes. The book of Genesis, of course, gave us "Let there be light," and there was light, and God saw that the light was good, while the seminal 1980s new wave band The Smiths assured us there is a light that never goes out. And somewhere in between those two illuminating assertions, we find the immortal last words of Goethe, "Light, more light." We at Museum Confidential wish to endorse all of the above, offering moreover our sincerest thanks to Good Lighting, which enlightens the art, quite literally, and always reminds us to look on the bright side.
When you have moments like the horrible hurricane and flooding that happened in Houston and the surrounding areas fairly recently, or you have a tragedy of any kind, you know, do you see the usage of the space increase in moments where people need to find solace?
You know, at times of disaster, however defined, the chapel is one very, very important place in this city, a public place where people will gather. Just in the last few years, there was the horrific bombing in Brussels, and we had part of the community that came and said, could we hold a memorial service, just a memorial gathering, more like a vigil here. And it was, I think we had 200 people inside and another 50 or 100 outside. It just became a natural gathering place. And then after Harvey, what we did is every week we had guided meditations from a variety of traditions, and people came to that. And I think part of it was really to be in company, to be in fellowship with other people, because at times of tragedy like that, you can feel very isolated. And so the Rothko Chapel becomes a place where people will gravitate toward because of what we stand for, but I think also the fact that it's a place, a community where you can, you don't really have to ask, why are you here? You kind of know why you're here, because you're here with fellow seekers and people from a variety of walks of life. So it becomes a natural kind of gathering place because of the spirituality and because it's such a welcoming place.
If you were a chef in a restaurant and you cooked every day in this restaurant, the last place you probably would want to eat dinner is this restaurant because you're working there all the time. Are you still able to find the same joy in the space that guests are, you know, since you're there all the time, you run the space? Has its power diminished or only increased by you being there so often since you've taken over the reins there at the chapel?
I like how you set that up. We oftentimes, I'll say kind of internally, you know, it's a little bit like the cobbler's children have no shoes, in the sense that, you know, I'm here all the time, and professionally so often I get caught up in, we're doing a capital campaign right now, some new site development. We've got renovations planned for the chapel, board of directors, you know, finances, the latest leak in one of our buildings. And it's so easy to lose the sense of the space. And yet every day, even if it's for 5 or 10 minutes, I try to make sure that I'm there. I attend just about every one of the public programs we do, partially because the energy comes from those who come here. I'm always intrigued by why people come to the Rothko Chapel. And so part of that nourishment is really engaging with people who come to visit the chapel, participate in programs. Some may only be coming as they're tourists, they're visiting Houston, it was on their bucket list, and just to chat with them a little bit. And people who come here. We have people who come almost every day or every other day. And that's, I think, where I find a lot of depth of meaning. And it helps me to see the chapel constantly through different eyes. And as such, then it becomes always kind of a investigative, questing place where I, you know, find in the repetition, I also find new insights and renewal for me personally.
In our gallery of Italian Renaissance paintings at Philbrook, we have several portraits of saints by Vittore Carpaccio, including one of Saint Stephen from 1510. Before coming to Philbrook in the early 1940s, the painting made a stop at the National Gallery in Washington, D.C. We have a great photo of Albert Einstein next to that painting. We post it every couple of years. It's social media gold. Einstein's comments on both art and religion are overused ad nauseum for every purpose under the sun. But imagine writing a letter to Einstein, and more importantly, imagine him writing back. That's exactly what happened in 1936 when a schoolgirl named Phyllis wrote the famous scientist, asking if one could believe in religion and science simultaneously. Here's what he wrote back. "Dear Phyllis, I will attempt to reply to your question as simply as I can. Here is my answer. Scientists believe that every occurrence, including the affairs of human beings, is due to the laws of nature. Therefore, a scientist cannot be inclined to believe that the course of events can be influenced by prayer, that is, by a supernaturally manifested wish. However, we must concede that our actual knowledge of these forces is imperfect, so that in the end, the belief in the existence of a final, ultimate spirit rests on a kind of faith. Such belief remains widespread even with the current achievements in science. But also, everyone who is seriously involved in the pursuit of science becomes convinced that some spirit is manifest in the laws of the universe, one that is vastly superior to that of man. In this way, the pursuit of science leads to a religious feeling of a special sort, which is surely quite different from the religiosity of someone more naive. With cordial greetings, Albert Einstein." That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.
Let's go!
And that's going to do it for Studio Tulsa today. You've been listening to a Museum Confidential podcast. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.